The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today we are taking on a really important topic, one that's everywhere in the news but often, well, pretty misunderstood: fundamentalism.
That's right. We're diving into Malise Ruthven's fundamentalism, a very short introduction. It's a concise but honestly a really powerful analysis.
And if you listening think fundamentalism is just, you know, very devout traditional religion, well, Ruthven's work might just reshape how you think about it.
Definitely. He really pushes back against how the term gets thrown around, especially in media. He argues it's often so vague, it just doesn't help us understand these global movements accurately.
So our goal here isn't judgment, it's clarity. We're digging into Ruthven's big question. Is fundamentalism something old, like a relic from the past?
Or is it actually, as he puts it, a quintessentially modern phenomenon? That's the core we're exploring. We want the tools to grasp its complexity across different religions. And Malise Ruthven seems like the perfect guide for this. He's an Irish-born British author, academic, journalist, quite the background.
Yeah, decades of experience looking right at that intersection of faith and, well, global politics.
What really stands out is his dual authority, you could say. He's got the academic rigor, a Cambridge degree,
but also that real-world experience. He worked for the BBC World Service, even produced for the Arabic Service. That's invaluable insight.
Exactly. It gives him this blend of, like, critical distance, but also empathy. He knows the subject deeply, especially Islam. Look at his book, Islam in the World.
So he doesn't just dismiss these movements. He tries to explain why they gain traction, why these political projects become so potent now, you know, in our globalized world.
Okay, so let's get into his main idea. Ruthven is pretty clear. Fundamentalism isn't just old school traditionalism.
No, not at all. He defines it very specifically as a reactive and defensive response.
Reactive to what?
To the pressures of modernity. Things like secularism, globalization, all the rapid social changes that seem to push religion to the sidelines, out of the public square.
And he avoids a one-size-fits-all definition, right? He thinks trying to lump, say, the American Christian right and Iranian Islamists under one simple label is misleading.
Precisely. It's an intellectual trap, he says. So instead, he uses this concept from the philosopher Wittgenstein, family resemblances.
Family resemblances. Okay, explain that a bit.
Well, think of a family. Members might share certain features, maybe the nose or a certain way of talking, but there isn't one single feature everyone has that defines the whole family.
Ah, I see. So fundamentalist groups are like that. They share overlapping traits, but no single checklist applies perfectly to all of them.
Exactly. It's a network of shared features. Like, insisting scripture is absolutely inerrant, but often through what he calls selective literalism.
Selective literalism, meaning they pick and choose which parts to take literally.
Kind of, yeah. Focusing on certain texts while maybe downplaying others. Then there's a strong, often militant opposition to secularism and modern science, especially Darwinism.
Okay, what else is in this family resemblance network?
A big one is asserting patriarchal control over women, the family structure. That's almost always central.
Right, defending the traditional family unit.
And finally, this really powerful drive, you see it again and again, to translate their private faith into public law, into actual political power.
That seems crucial. It's not just belief, it's a project.
It's almost always a political project. Okay, so where did the term itself even come from?
Right, let's trace that. Ruthven points to early 20th century America, specifically American Protestantism.
Yeah, these pamphlets published between 1910 and 1915, called The Fundamentals. That's where the name originates.
And what were they fundamentally about?
Defending core doctrines, the virgin birth, biblical inerrancy, that sort of thing, against what they saw as liberal theology creeping into the churches, challenging traditional beliefs.
And this tension blew up spectacularly with the Scopes monkey trial in 1925, right? The teacher prosecuted for teaching evolution.
That was the big public showdown. Ooh. And it had lasting consequences.
How so? Didn't the fundamentalists technically win the court case?
They did, legally. John Scopes was fined, but in the court of public opinion, they lost badly. The national press, figures like H.L. Mencken, just ridiculed them as backward, anti-intellectual.
So a Pyrrhic victory. What happened then?
It led to a strategic retreat. They pulled back from mainstream politics, kind of turned inward, focusing on building their own subculture, churches, Bible colleges, radio programs.
But they didn't stay retreated forever. Decades later, they reemerged as the Christian right, a very organized political force. How did that happen? You mentioned dispensationalism. That sounds complex.
It is a bit dense, but it's really key to understanding their political actions, especially regarding Israel.
Oh.
Dispensationalism basically divides history into different eras or dispensations,
okay,
and it outlines a specific sequence of end times events predicted in the Bible.
So how does that connect to modern politics, like supporting Israel?
Because for many dispensationalists, the existence of the modern state of Israel, and specifically Jewish control over Jerusalem, is seen as a necessary precondition, a fulfillment of prophecy that has to happen before Christ returns and the rapture occurs.
Wow. So for them, supporting Israel isn't just foreign policy.
It's a theological necessity. It's about advancing God's timeline. That's a direct link from private belief to unavoidable public political action.
That's a fascinating example. And it highlights this distinction Ruthven makes, right? Between movements that retreat from the world and those trying to conquer it. Does that apply to Jewish fundamentalism too?
Absolutely. He draws a really sharp contrast there. On one hand, you have the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox.
They seem more world-renouncing.
Very much so. Their focus is internal, strict adherence to halakha, Jewish law, maintaining separation from secular society. It's about preserving their community through isolation.
But then there's Gush Emunim, the bloc of the faithful.
Completely different approach. They are the classic example of religious nationalism, fusing messianic beliefs with modern political goals.
When did they emerge?
Really after the 1967 Six-Day War. They interpreted Israel's victory as a divine sign. Their project became explicitly political and territorial.
Settling the West Bank.
Yes, settling the West Bank, asserting Jewish control over the biblical lands, partly driven by the belief that this would hasten the Messiah's arrival. It shows how fundamentalism can fuel territorial conflict.
So we see this fusion of religion and nationalism. How does that play out in the Islamic context? Ruthven notes something interesting about the leadership there.
Yeah, this is a crucial point. He stresses that modern Islamism, groups like the Muslim Brotherhood initially, often aren't led by the traditional religious scholars the ulema trained in seminaries.
So who leads them?
Often it's modern educated lay people, engineers, doctors, teachers, people who feel deeply alienated by both Western secular culture and, importantly, their own secularized governments back home.
That's counterintuitive. You'd expect traditional clergy. So who provided the intellectual firepower for this more radical turn?
The key figure Ruthven highlights is Sayyid Qutbo, an Egyptian intellectual originally associated with the Muslim Brotherhood.
And his big idea
was this radical reinterpretation of Jahiliya. Traditionally, that term referred to the state of ignorance and barbarism in Arabia before Islam.
Okay, ancient history.
But Qutbo argued that Jahiliya wasn't just historical. He applied it to modern Muslim societies, especially those led by secular rulers who weren't implementing Sharia law. He essentially declared them to be in a state of pagan ignorance.
Applying pagan ignorance to modern Muslim leaders? That sounds incredibly radical, like a justification for
revolution, exactly. For Qutbo, if these regimes were effectively pagan, then jihad understood as revolutionary struggle became not just permissible, but necessary to overthrow them and establish a true Islamic state. His ideas became hugely influential for radical groups worldwide.
And the prime example of a fundamentalist movement actually succeeding in taking state power. That has to be Iran, right?
The 1979 Iranian Revolution is the textbook case, led by Ayatollah Khomeini.
What was key to its success, according to Ruthven?
It was this potent mix. Khomeini brilliantly blended Shiite theology with modern anti-imperialist populist rhetoric that resonated widely. It wasn't just religious, it was also nationalist and anti-Western.
And it proved that this model could work.
It proved that a fundamentalist movement could not only seize power, but actually run a modern nation state, using its infrastructure to enforce religious law, a major turning point.
What's really striking in Ruthven's analysis is how he argues this isn't just a Middle Eastern or Abrahamic phenomenon, it's global. He points to India, for instance.
Right. He analyzes Hindutva, often translated as Hinduness. This isn't ancient Hinduism, it's a modern political ideology.
Promoted by groups like the RSS and the political party, the BJP.
Exactly. And its goal is to define Indian national identity in exclusively Hindu terms. It pushes back against India's secular foundations, much like other fundamentalisms push against secularism elsewhere. It idealizes a mythical Hindu golden age.
And the destruction of the Babri Mosque in Ayodhya in 1992.
Ruthven points to that as a key symbolic moment. It crystallized the movement's militant revisionist agenda, literally trying to erase a symbol of Muslim presence to reclaim a supposedly ancient Hindu site.
So whether it's American Protestants, Jewish settlers, Iranian revolutionaries, or Hindu nationalists.
Or, as he briefly mentioned, Sikh fundamentalists or militant Buddhist nationalists in places like Sri Lanka or Myanmar. The underlying pattern, Ruthven argues, is structural. It's a response to modernity that cuts across different faiths.
Okay, that's a lot to absorb. If we had to pull out, say, three main takeaways, the real so what insights from this global view, what would they be?
Well, first, something we saw almost everywhere, the centrality of patriarchy.
Controlling women's roles, bodies, sexuality.
It's a near universal obsession. Why? Because the so-called traditional family is seen as the last defense against the perceived moral chaos of secularism and individualism. Protecting the family becomes paramount.
It shows how anxieties about social change get focused onto gender and family. Okay, what's the second big theme?
This one really challenges stereotypes. The selective modernity paradox.
Meaning they aren't actually anti-modern?
Not in practice, no. They aren't Luddites rejecting technology. They're actually quite pragmatic. They readily use modern tools, the internet, mass media, sophisticated political organizing.
But they use these modern tools to fight the ideas of modernity.
Precisely. They use modern means to combat modern philosophies like pluralism, individual rights, secular reason. It's using the enemy's weapons against the enemy's worldview.
Fascinating paradox. And the third key theme.
It flows from the others. This is almost always an inevitable political project.
It's rarely just about private belief or spirituality.
Very rarely. At its heart, fundamentalism is a political reaction. It's reacting against religion being pushed out of public life by the secular state.
Yeah.
They fundamentally reject that separation.
And the ultimate goal is?
To bring divine law back into the public sphere, to reclaim public authority for religion, to impose their vision on society.
Ruthven really distills these complex movements. He has some very quotable lines that capture his thinking. Can we share a few?
Absolutely. Here's one that sums up the core argument about modernity.
Fundamentalist movements are not relics of a bygone era, but are quintessentially modern phenomena born out of a confrontation with a secular modernity that threatens to render religion irrelevant.
It flips the script, doesn't it?
Yeah.
They aren't just surviving modernity. Modernity created the conditions for them.
Okay, here's another one about how they use scripture. The fundamentalist seeks to remake the world in the image of scripture, but must first remake scripture in the image of the world he seeks to create.
Ah, that's the selective literalism point again. It highlights the active interpretation involved. They claim absolute adherence, but it's always an interpretation tailored to their specific, usually modern political goals.
Very insightful. And finally, this important nuance about violence. Violence is not intrinsic to fundamentalism, but fundamentalism creates conditions where violence becomes theologically justifiable.
That's crucial for accurate analysis. The worldview itself, black and white thinking, us versus them, rejecting compromise, makes violence seem like a legitimate, even necessary option when political means fail or aren't available, even if violence wasn't the starting point.
So how can listeners use these insights? Let's make it practical. How does this help us understand the news better?
Well, first, just use that family resemblance idea as a tool. When you hear a group called extremist, pause. Ask, okay, what specific traits do they show? What are they reacting against? Are they withdrawing like the Haredim or trying to take over the state like Gush Emunah or the Iranian revolutionaries?
So moving beyond labels to specific characteristics.
Exactly. It replaces lazy thinking with more precise questions. Is their project mainly social, political, violent? It helps you differentiate.
And it sheds light on political dynamics too, right? Things that might just look like power struggles.
Absolutely. Understanding the ideology helps explain why certain issues become so central. Why, say, the U.S. Christian right focuses so heavily on court appointments, or why Hindutva fuels specific social tensions in India. You see the underlying reactive project.
And does it offer any clues for recognizing radicalization?
I think so. Ruthven identifies a common pattern in the more radical forms. This intense dualism, the world divided into pure us and corrupt them, a strong sense of being persecuted or victimized, and often a charismatic leader offering absolute certainty in a complex world.
Seeing that pattern, dualism, persecution complex, charismatic leader, that could be a warning sign in various contexts.
It's a structural pattern to watch for, yeah. Essential for spotting intolerance before it escalates.
For me, the biggest surprise, or maybe takeaway, was realizing just how modern these movements really are. Learning that someone like Qutrbab, a key architect of radical Islamism, wasn't a traditional cleric, but a modern educated layman. That really drove home the point that this is born from modern pressures, not just surviving despite them.
I agree. And for me, the most valuable thing is the analytical framework itself. Ruthven gives us the tools to look at fundamentalism not just with condemnation, though criticism is often warranted, but with analysis.
To understand it as this sophisticated, adaptive, and yes, intensely modern force.
Right. It forces us to ask better questions. Not just what's wrong with these religious people, but what specific modern anxieties are these movements tapping into, and what kind of power are they trying to build in response? It completely reframes how we should think about religion's role today.
A crucial reframing indeed. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.